The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And today we're reading from The Week magazine, dated June 14th, 2013. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article this week is entitled, The Hunt for a White House Link to the IRS Scandal. Republican lawmakers intensified efforts this past week to directly link the White House with the Internal Revenue Service scandal, as conservative groups subjected to the agency's heightened scrutiny testified before Congress for the first time. Representative Daryl Issa, a Republican from California, the chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, claimed that employees from the IRS's Cincinnati office had privately told his office that the targeting of 500 conservative groups was directly ordered by Washington, though he conceded he had no direct evidence of that. In congressional hearings, anti-abortion, pro-marriage, and Tea Party-affiliated groups testified that they had faced years of delays and politically motivated harassment from the IRS after applying for tax exemption. Betty Gerritsen, leader of an Alabama Tea Party group, told lawmakers she had to hire attorneys to deal with the avalanche of paperwork required by the agency. This was a willful act of intimidation to discourage a point of view, she said. The IRS also came under fire for profligate spending this week after a Treasury audit revealed it had spent $50 million on over 200 employee conferences between 2010 and 2012. Acting IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel called the spending an unfortunate vestige from a prior era and pledged to regain the nation's trust. The agency stands ready to confront the problems that occurred, he said. Now here's what the editorials had to say. The testimony of conservative groups vividly demonstrated why this scandal far exceeds previous abuses of the tax agency, said the Washington Examiner. While Franklin Roosevelt and Richard Nixon scrutinized the returns of powerful political enemies, this time the IRS went after ordinary Americans driven by simple love of country. You don't have to be conservative to understand the stone-cold fear these people must have felt, said the Boston Herald. The IRS is the one federal agency you don't argue with, the agency with the power to audit, to make life miserable, and to ruin. The IRS's behavior was certainly troubling, said the Baltimore Sun, but seems little connected to the chief executive. No evidence has yet emerged that the White House even knew about what was happening at the IRS, let alone ordered it. That hasn't stopped Republicans from leveling wild accusations at Obama on the slightest thread of hearsay. Why doesn't the GOP at least pretend to be conducting a real investigation instead of concocting unsupported allegations? Now here's what the columnist said. The Republicans have always believed Obama is guilty of everything and anything, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, and so they are going to hold hearings until they confirm their conclusions. Daryl Issa makes for a perfect investigator since he knows so much about unethical behavior, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. This camera-chasing right-wing caricature was once indicted for stealing his brother's car and later accused of torching his own car alarm factory for an insurance payout. Talk about ethically compromised. The evidence of White House involvement is real, said Andrew Stiles in NationalReview.com. White House logs show that the now deposed commissioner of the IRS, Douglas Shulman, visited the White House 157 times, whereas his predecessor did so once. why. It's also telling that Shulman's wife, Susan Anderson, is an Obama supporter who works for Public Campaign, a liberal nonprofit group. The idea that politics had nothing to do with this scandal is becoming harder and harder to believe. Shulman did not visit the White House 157 times, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. The logs show only that Shulman was given security for 157 routine White House gatherings to discuss such matters as the IRS's role in Obamacare, not to meet with Obama. The records show he actually attended only 11 of these events, and yet conservatives continue to push a bogus story. By trying so hard to turn this into Watergate, Republicans only hurt themselves, said Leonard Pitts in the Miami Herald. Even the Republican National Committee chair, Rents Priebus, cautioned his party to pull back on the impeachment rhetoric, saying the scandal might have a greater impact if we present ourselves as intelligent. As ESA is demonstrating, that is a mighty big if. The next item from the main story section this week, Christie's Senate seat strategy. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie angered both Republicans and Democrats this past week by announcing an October special election to fill the seat of Democratic Senator Frank Laudenberg, who died last week. The Republicans sidestepped two conflicting options under state laws. He could have appointed a replacement to serve until the November 2014 election, or held a special election this November 5th, the same day he is up for re-election himself. Christie reportedly avoided the latter option because popular New York Mayor Cory Booker is expected to get the Democratic nomination for the Senate and would draw many Democrats to the polls, cutting into Christie's expected large margin of victory. Christie said he would quickly appoint an interim senator to serve until October 16th, when the special election would guarantee the people of New Jersey both a choice and a voice in the process. Holding a special election 20 days before Election Day is a shameless move, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial, one that will cost taxpayers $25 million. There's only one reason for this purely self-serving decision. Christie wants to win the gubernatorial election by 30 points to show national Republicans he is a strong presidential candidate who can win in blue states in 2016. He's wasted a big opportunity for the GOP, said Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com. Christie was well within his rights to fill the seat with a Republican until November 2014. That extra vote would have helped Senate conservatives fend off the Obama agenda for another 17 months and allowed a Republican appointee to build visibility and support before running for the seat. Typically, Christie put his own political interests over those of his party. This decision is a work of political genius, said Sean Trend in RealClearPolitics.com. By refusing to appoint a Republican for a full year, Christie comes off as less partisan, which will help him win votes in New Jersey, where Democrats and independents dominate. And by placing the special election in October, he makes it more likely that he'll get his overwhelming victory in November, which he'll use to build momentum for his 2016 presidential campaign. Critics are whining today, but 4 years from now, we might look back and marvel at Christie's adroit moves. The next item from the main story section, court approves DNA swabs. The Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision this past week that police are justified in taking DNA samples from anyone who's arrested. Taking and analyzing a cheek swab of the arrestee's DNA is like fingerprinting and photographing, a legitimate police booking procedure that is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote, but conservative Justin Antonin Scalia, in a sharply worded dissent, joined by liberal Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, said the express purpose of DNA collection was not to identify a suspect, but to link him to other crimes. Make no mistake about it, he said from the bench. Because of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national database if you are ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason. DNA is just the 21st century equivalent of fingerprinting, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Police routinely run database checks of arrestees' fingerprints to match them with past crimes. How is this different? It's more accurate, that's all, said the Baltimore Sun. Not only can DNA link suspects to unsolved crimes, it can also help exonerate the innocent and free the falsely convicted. And swiping a cotton swab on the inside of the cheek is arguably less invasive than inking a suspect's fingers. But the case in question proves Scalia's point, said Jeffrey Rosen in the New Republic. Maryland police booked Alonzo King on assault allegations, took his DNA without a warrant, and found that it matched that from an unsolved 2003 rape, for which he was then convicted. Until now, the Supreme Court allowed such suspicionless searches only if there was some public safety justification, such as airport security scans. Antonin Scalia shines brightest when he serves as the court's liberal conscience, said Walter Olson in the DailyBeast.com, and he's right to worry about a slippery slope. How long before you'll be asked to give a DNA swab before you can board a plane or just drive your car? And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the main story section of the week this week, entitled Holder, the mounting pressure for his resignation. It's time for Attorney General Eric Holder to resign, said Jay Sekulow in FoxNews.com, when it was revealed last month that his Justice Department had spied on journalists from Fox News and the Associated Press who published classified leaks. The nation's top law enforcement official denied any responsibility, telling Congress that the potential prosecution of the press was not something that I've ever been involved with. But this was not true. It's been revealed that Holder not only knew of the leak investigations, he signed a search warrant application in 2010 calling Fox News reporter James Rosen a probable co-conspirator in a crime. By misleading Congress, Holder may have committed perjury, and that's merely his latest offense. Last year, he was held in contempt of Congress when he stonewalled an investigation into the Fast and Furious gun-running fiasco, and on matters large and small, has consistently misled Congress and the American people. Even some Obama aides say they're tired of Holder's penchant for polarizing episodes and would like to see him step down, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. The White House is apoplectic about him and has been for a long time, said a Democratic insider. Holder has done nothing wrong, said Jonathan Capehart in the Washington Post. The Justice Department investigated Rosen but did not prosecute him, so Holder told the truth. The investigation's real target was the State Department employee who leaked confidential information about North Korea. Ordinarily, Republicans would applaud a national security prosecution, but Holder is now a central figure in their proxy war with President Obama. There's an undeniable thread of racial resentment in the GOP's hatred of Holder, said Alex Seitz-Wald in Salon.com. The tone was set in 2009 when Holder said the U.S. was essentially a nation of cowards on the subject of race, a comment that lit up conservative talk radio and Fox for a week. Conservatives were further infuriated when Holder compared voter ID laws to Jim Crow, with the Wall Street Journal accusing Holder of trying to stir up racial incitement. There are better reasons for this attorney general to go, said Jonathan Turley in USA Today. Holder is what we call a sin eater inside the Beltway, high-ranking associates who shield presidents from responsibility for their actions. When the Obama administration decided to expand the warrantless surveillance of Americans' emails, Holder was dispatched to justify the policy. When the president wanted the authority to kill U.S. citizens by drone without charge or trial, it was the attorney general who concocted the legal excuse. Justices press investigations serve as further proof that Holder, like Obama, has no respect for privacy rights, press freedom, and due process. Still, Holder won't be fired or quit immediately, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. Obama will wait to see if Holder is doing durable damage to his administration. If he is, the president, a product of the ruthless Chicago way, will let his fall guy take the fall. Actually, Holder is likely to keep his job, but only because of the same GOP now calling for his head, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. Senate Republicans have been using the filibuster to block Obama's nominations. Those same senators would vehemently object to anyone Obama would select to replace Holder. So rather than get tied up in another confirmation battle for months, Obama will stick with the damaged guy he's got. Republican extremism, in other words, may be the ultimate reason Holder holds on. Now we'll turn from the controversy of the week on The Week magazine to the popular column Good Week for and Bad Week for. It was a good week for customer service after Al-Qaeda's branch in Iraq and Syria set up complaints departments for anyone who might have a complaint against any element of the Islamic State. The organization promised accountability. And it was a good week for really prompt delivery after Domino's asked a British company to test the feasibility of delivering pizzas by drone. We're serious about it, said Tom Hatton, the founder of the company, which just used a small drone to test deliver two pepperoni pizzas. It was a bad week for failing to scoop after the Spanish town of Brunette drastically cut the amount of dog poop on its streets by mailing offending deposits back to the owners in boxes marked Lost Property. It was a bad week for gaming the system after a North Carolina postal worker receiving workers' compensation payments for a shoulder injury suffered 9 years ago was forced to admit that he was a fraud. The worker gave herself away by appearing on TV's The Price is Right and spinning the big wheel twice without any difficulty. And it was a bad week for doomed romances after a confused young moose bull became obsessed with a life-size metal statue of a moose in a Colorado garden, repeatedly nuzzling it and trying to mount it, said a witness to the moose's ardor. He is in love. Now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section. Our article this week is entitled, The IRS as a Political Weapon. The Internal Revenue Service, which has admitted selectively auditing conservative groups, has a long history of scandal. Why was the IRS created? When the U.S. was founded, it had no tax-collecting agency and little need for one for the next 80 years. The much smaller federal government of that era was funded largely by customs tariffs and state-collected excise taxes on sugar, liquor, and tobacco. But when the Civil War began, President Abraham Lincoln needed new revenues to cover the immense cost of waging the war. So in 1862, he successfully pushed Congress to create the country's first income tax and the Bureau of Internal Revenue Service to collect it. 7 years after the Civil War ended, the income tax was repealed, and again the government financed its operations mostly through taxes on alcohol and tobacco. But in the Progressive Era, in the early 20th century, reformers argued that such taxes unfairly penalize the poor. At the same time, Hawks wanted more revenue to build up the U.S. military. In 1913, the 16th Amendment was ratified, instituting the income tax for good. How quickly did the taxing authority expand? Within years of the income tax's creation, World War I drove top tax rates to 77%. The number of tax returns also exploded from 778,289 back in 1916 to 7.6 million in 1920, and the agency was hard-pressed to keep up. After 1919, it also fell to the Bureau of Internal Revenue to enforce prohibition. From the outset, overworked agents were susceptible to corruption and political influence in deciding whose returns to audit. Franklin D. Roosevelt brazenly used IRS audits as a weapon against conservative publishers William Randolph Hearst and Moses Annenberg, right-wing radio demagogue Father Charles Coughlin, and industrialist Andrew Mellon. FDR would not be alone in succumbing to that temptation. In almost every administration since the IRS's inception, wrote David Burnham, author of A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS, the information and power of the tax agency have been mobilized for explicitly political purposes. Did that lead to scandals? Pretty regularly. In 1951, congressional Republicans uncovered widespread corruption at the Bureau of Internal Revenue, leading to the dismissal of 66 agents for such activities as bribe-taking and extortion. President Harry S. Truman proposed a reorganization in which tax agents would be hired through the civil service rather than political patronage. Republican Dwight Eisenhower endorsed Truman's reform plans and in 1953 changed the agency's name to the Internal Revenue Service. Did those reforms bear fruit? Too often, they did not. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's counterintelligence project, codenamed COINTELPRO, had unlimited access to the IRS files of such suspected subversive organizations as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the National Council of Churches. It even ordered an IRS audit of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In the early 1960s, the IRS responded to President John F. Kennedy's public complaints about tax-exempt conservative groups by setting up the Ideological Organization's Audit Project, which challenged their tax status. But it was President Richard Nixon who most blatantly wielded the IRS as a political weapon. What did Nixon do? The White House tapes recorded Nixon urging aide John Ehrlichman in 1971 to get the IRS to dig into the tax returns of possible Democratic presidential candidate Senators Edmund Muskie, Hubert Humphrey, and Ted Kennedy. "I can only hope that we are, frankly, doing a little persecuting," Nixon said. "There's a lot of gold in them, there are hills." In 1969, the Nixon administration set up an IRS unit called the Special Service Staff, which used tax records to assemble dossiers on more than 11,000 groups and individuals. After the 1972 election, Nixon staffers gave the IRS a list of 576 supporters of Democrat George McGovern. In 1974, one of the articles of impeachment against Nixon charged him with seeking confidential information contained in income tax returns for purposes not authorized by law. Did Watergate end IRS abuses? There have been plenty of questionable audits since the Nixon era, including one of Paula Jones after she refused to settle a sexual harassment suit against President Bill Clinton. His White House denied any role. The IRS recently admitted that its division overseeing tax-exempt organizations had singled out groups with Tea Party and Patriots in their names for special scrutiny. In its own defense, the IRS says enforcing tax law laws effectively but impartially becomes harder each year, given the cuts to its operating budget, which is down 8% since 2010, and the growing complexity of the federal tax code. The tax code has been amended 4,680 times in the past 12 years alone, and now runs to some 74,000 pages. Such complexity creep only confirms taxpayers' suspicions that the tax laws are designed to entrap them and obscure what is and what is not being taxed, wrote National Taxpayer Advocate Nina Olson in her last annual report. This is no way to run a tax system. And the footnote to this briefing section is entitled, Refusing to Pay Taxes. I like to pay taxes. With them, I buy civilization, Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said. But ever since federal income taxes were first levied, many Americans have disliked taxes so strongly that they've refused to pay them. Wichita contractor Arthur Porth unsuccessfully argued in a 1954 case that taxation amounts to involuntary servitude, making it illegal under the 13th Amendment. More recently, a Pennsylvania small business owner named Larkin Rose concocted a so-called 861 argument named after the section of the code that lays out the sources of taxable income. In Rose's arcane reading of that section, which he turned into a video that sold more than 15,000 copies, only income derived from international commerce or federal possessions is taxable. Courts have repeatedly rejected this reading of the code, and Rose has served 15 months in jail for tax evasion. Nonetheless, actor Wesley Snipes tried a version of the 861 argument to explain why he paid no taxes on $38 million he earned from 1999 to 2004. Unmoved, a judge sentenced him to 3 years in prison. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week, June 14th, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today on this program. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the week. The first one is entitled, Is the Media Turning on Obama? Written by Kimberly A. Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. Of the three scandals currently plaguing the White House, said Kimberly Strassel, it's the one the public cares about least that could do real damage. Only 15% of voters care much about the Justice Department's seizure of reporters' records at the Associated Press and Fox News. Most people think the IRS scandal and Benghazi are more important. But it's the scandal over the startlingly aggressive intrusion into press freedom that really has the White House worried. President Obama and his aides know that they can't dismiss the snooping on the press as a Republican witch hunt, and that it's caused real disgust among liberal activists and the press, the very people Obama has relied on for years as his frontline defense. Until now, the press has always attacked Obama's enemies and downplayed damaging events like Benghazi. But now that reporters have seen proof that this administration is hostile to journalism itself, they're going after evasive administration officials with a vengeance. Suddenly, the media is wondering what else this administration isn't being straight on. For Obama, that's a very dangerous question for journalists to ask. The next column is entitled, When Work is Your Entire Life, by Joan Williams in the Harvard Business Review. How many employed American mothers work more than 50 hours a week? Asked Joan Williams. Just 9%, according to U.S. Census Bureau data. That statistic, more than any other factor, explains why the percentage of working women in top jobs has stalled at 14%, and why work-life balance in this country is so grim. Most working mothers simply refuse to work from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. because of this one little hang-up. They want to see their children awake. Professional men also would like to see their kids, but for them, working 50 to 60 hours a week is an unspoken job requirement. Within companies and in upper middle class culture, workaholism now serves as a badge of manly heroism and as proof of elite status. Today, when men say how slammed they are at work, to the point of sleeplessness and physical exhaustion, they're bragging, not complaining. It's a way of saying, I am so important. Women with families, by and large, do not buy into this macho work culture. So if institutions are serious about advancing women, they'll have to address the hours problems. And the next column is Why Fox is Crushing MSNBC, by Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. It's a depressing time to be a liberal, said Paul Waldman. Last month, MSNBC experienced its worst ratings in years, plunging from its usual second-place spot among cable news channels to fourth place. Liberal blogs, too, have experienced serious declines in traffic since the election. Why? The left is adrift in the post-election doldrums. For 10 years, starting with George Bush's decision to launch the Iraq War and continuing through Barack Obama's re-election, liberals have been angry, excited, and engaged. But look where we are now. Obama is hamstrung by Congress and a series of faux scandals, and liberals are viewing him with growing ambivalence. Conservative media outlets like Fox News, on the other hand, are, as always, in full alert mode, stirring up their older conservative audiences into a perpetual state of anger and outrage. Every liberal proposal is the end of freedom. Every liberal politician, the most terrifying villain America has ever seen. Over on MSNBC, Chris Hayes is moderating a thoughtful discussion about economic inequality. No wonder the right is winning the ratings wars. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine, The Week, to the last word. The article this week is entitled, When Escape is the Only Option. Domestic abuse is often more about power than violence, said Natasha Gardner. This is one woman's story. Not long before she fled, Crystal Ryan had $650 to her name. Not his, not theirs, just hers. She'd been squirreling it away for a month, knowing he'd ask for it when the bills came. Make that demand it. If she didn't have it, he'd know something was up. She used to buy bus tickets to Denver, even though the purchase ate up $585. It left the three of them, Crystal and her kids, 14-year-old Jay and 11-year-old Adara, with $65 to start a new life. For shelter, to eat. Of course, it wasn't enough. She couldn't think about that, or she'd turn back. Every dozen or so seconds in the United States, a woman is beaten, assaulted, or strangled. Domestic violence is the top cause of injury for American women between the ages of 15 and 44. It wasn't until the 1970s that many states finally agreed a wife could be raped by her husband. What seems intuitive now, that a wife and husband each have equal legal power over their bodies, was an ideological nuclear bomb in the 70s. The laws remain difficult to enforce, partly because the term domestic violence is a misnomer. Abusive relationships often are less about actual violence than about control and power. Domestic violence involves a warped dynamic that, whether or not a criminal act has been committed, is often misunderstood by people outside the relationship. By the time Terrence, and that's not his real name, landed in Crystal's life, she wasn't looking for a man. She was 27, raising her children, paying the bills, and getting a licensed practical nurse, an LPN degree. She worked as a night auditor at a Ramada Inn in Virginia. She was an engineer from Houston who stayed there for a few months while on a job. He showed up, and he kept coming back night after night. She rarely dated and never brought anyone home to meet the children, but Terrence proved to be too good to ignore. At 6 feet 3 inches, with powerful arms that he'd wrap around her, he quickly convinced her that he was wonderful, safe. He wanted to meet her kids. After 3 months, she agreed. "I'm going to be the father figure," he told them. "I love you guys. We're a family now." Crystal had one thought. This is it. Maybe she saw a few warning signs. Terrence could be intensely protective, didn't like her stepping out without her man, didn't like men talking to her at clubs. But that's because he was worried about her, right? He loved her and didn't want to share her with anyone else. When he asked her to leave school early to join him at his new work site in Chicago, she agreed it would be a honeymoon, a test. She left the kids with her half-sister for a little while. Crystal was finally letting go and allowing herself to trust someone. For a while, it was fun. There were parties, nice cars, dancing in hotel rooms. But one night, he thought she danced too close to another man, and Terrence hit her. Another time, he saw a guy at a club approach her. Even though she was careful to point out her boyfriend, Terrence slapped her on the drive back to the hotel. She hit him in the forehead with her shoe. It drew blood. She wasn't a pushover. She'd fight back. One night they were at a cookout at the hotel, and Terrence wanted to leave. Crystal wasn't ready yet. He hit her, grabbed her hair, and yanked her head back. When she woke up the next morning, she wouldn't leave the room. She'd been in Chicago less than a month. A woman she'd met there kept calling. Crystal didn't answer. Finally, the woman came to the hotel and made a manager let her into Crystal's room. "Oh, my," she said when she saw Crystal's face. "What happened?" "I had a seizure," Crystal lied. She couldn't stop lying to herself either. He was so different most of the time. That wasn't the man she met. Every day wasn't bad. Something had gone wrong those times, and it wasn't his fault. There isn't a definite predictor of why one person and not another becomes a victim. They don't look or act a certain way. Some live paycheck to paycheck. Others never worry about the rent. Some have PhDs. Others never made it through high school. Some are outspoken. Others are wallflowers. There's one commonality. They gravitate toward men who want to control them. This is why falling in love can turn out to be the most dangerous thing a woman ever does. There's one semi-reliable way to tell if someone might become a victim. Children who grow up around domestic violence are 15 times more likely to be abused themselves. Even worse, boys who witness abuse at home are twice as likely to become abusers because they've been rewired to think that it's normal. As many victims do, Crystal stayed because she loved him, because she thought having this man as a dad to her kids was better than having them grow up without one, because she was afraid, because she thought he'd stop. He routinely tore her down. She was too black, too fat, too ugly. "Who is going to want you?" he'd ask. "No one is going to want you but me." Verbal abuse, physical, it didn't really matter. She was already hurting, tired, before the abuse would even begin. So weary it became almost mundane. But there were moments when he seemed like the man she'd met in Virginia. He'd stroke her back, wrap his big arms around her. Even if those hands had hit her the night before, she wanted him. She stumbled upon a new way to delay his anger on the night of her 29th birthday. They were partying again with friends, and Crystal was drunk. Terrence gave her cocaine. She didn't want to take it, but she did anyway. The next morning, her nose was clogged, and she just didn't feel right. But he was so happy with her. The more they partied, the more they spent. Between their two jobs, the family should have been flush. Instead, they always seemed to live month to month. Then, Terrence lost his job. Crystal picked up double shifts to keep the lights on and the coke supply high. She was solely focused on making this man happy. If that meant she'd show up to work high or drunk, so be it. After last night's party, she needed to stay high to stay awake, and she needed to get high again tonight to keep him happy. She never seemed to sleep. Her boss started to comment on her persistent sinus infections. What Crystal loved most about her work was the chance to help people. She could do her rounds with her elderly patients and forget for a minute or two what a mess her life had become. She was exhausted so much that one day she sat down in a patient's room and didn't get up. She hadn't slept for 3 days. Now she did, while the patient she was supposed to be feeding lay helpless nearby. She awoke to see her supervisor hovering over her. There were no excuses this time. She was fired. In the next 6 months, she lost 2 more jobs. She'd never been fired in her life, but between the booze and the coke and him, she couldn't hold it together during the day. Then one day, a social worker from Child Protective Services visited her house. The woman began reading from a report. Everything she said was true. The children had recently spent the night sleeping on a neighbor's porch. Crystal had checked into a hospital that evening to recover from anemia and depression after yet another fight with Terrence, and she told the kids to stay at a nearby friend's house. When the neighbor wasn't home, Jay and Adora decided that sleeping outside, Terrence never hit the kids but was verbally abusive to them, was better than returning home without their mom. The social worker knew all about this, the fights, the drugs, the parties. But Terrence was home and came to the door, so Crystal lied. "No, my children were not outside," she said. "They were in the house, and I don't know who reported this." Jay and Adara seemed to understand, too, because they quickly echoed the lies. The case was dropped. Her fear intensified. She'd saved her kids from foster care, but for how long? What would she do the next time? So she said she was taking the kids for ice cream and left. Crystal and her kids arrived in Denver a few days later, after midnight, and the trio settled into an upstairs room at Safe House Denver, which is a local shelter. Her first step was to get sober. It didn't require a 12-step program. With Terrence gone, she no longer needed to get high. She moved her family to transitional housing and enrolled the kids in school. Next, she found an apartment and a job as an elder care assistant. For the first time she could remember, Crystal felt peaceful and content. She was starting to feel normal again when she received an email from Terrence. He'd met someone new and she was pregnant. It hurt Crystal because she still loved him, even though his news should have been a relief. Now he'd have less reason to track her down. She wrestled with jealousy. Terrence was with another woman who was carrying his child. He was stroking her back and wrapping his thick arms around her. And if she was being honest with herself, he was probably slapping her around, too. Crystal moves around the South Denver Elder Care Center, where she's the activities director. She works with patients who suffer from dementia. Her job enables her and the kids to live in their very own house through Section 8 assistance. She makes about $15 an hour, decent enough money, but she doesn't have insurance. "I have days when I realize I'm a single woman again. I'm almost 40 years old," Crystal says. "How did I get to this point in my life?" These days, Adara is sharp-witted yet kind, and so unlike the withdrawn girl she'd been in Houston. She only holds her head down now when she's scared. "Not very much," she boasts. She thinks about her future, hoping to be a professional basketball player in Europe, or a chef, maybe both, a traveling chef who shoots hoops. Jay, the son who Crystal once feared, would end up in jail as a high school senior on track to graduate this month. Then he's off to community college. Hopefully he'll transfer to CSU after a year. He's got the grades. He's interested in studying journalism and hip-hop fashion, and he'd also like to travel. Most nights, Crystal is home with her kids. They eat dinner on TV trays and watch movies. After the big house and the Mercedes she had in Houston, she's now earning a modest working wage and making do in a cozy and humble home. It's heaven. And that article was by Natasha Gardner. and it was reprinted by permission in 5280 magazine. Now from the last word to the health and science section of the Week magazine, our first article entitled, Why Frogs Are Disappearing. Amphibians may be the canary in the environmental coal mine. A major new study of America's frogs, salamanders, and toads by the U.S. Geological Survey has concluded that these species are dying off at an alarming rate. Over 9 years, the researchers observed 48 amphibian species in 34 locations from the wetlands of Florida to the mountains of Colorado and discovered that on average, their populations decline by almost 4% per year. Among 12 threatened species, the drop was even steeper at 11.6% a year. If these declines continue, many amphibian species will disappear from more than half of their habitat in 20 years. Particularly disturbing is the fact that amphibians are disappearing from protected and unprotected areas alike. Evidence that a complex combination of factors, including pesticide runoff and climate change, is taking a serious toll. Amphibians' permeable skin and the fact that they spend part of their life cycle on both land and water make them more vulnerable to environmental changes than other creatures are. Amphibians have been a constant presence in our planet's ponds, streams, lakes, and rivers for 350 million years or so, surviving countless changes that caused many other groups of animals to go extinct. USGS Director Suzette Kimball tells NPR.org, yet the pressures amphibians now face exceed the ability of many of these survivors to cope. The next item, the hazards of hoarding. In its early stages, hoarding begins with an inability to throw away junk mail, newspapers and magazines. Stacks of paper and junk turn into towers, and over time, hoarders find it increasingly difficult to throw anything away, including garbage. Once considered rare, hoarders make up 3-5% of the U.S. population, and more than 85 towns and cities have established task forces to deal with the hoarders in their communities, the New York Times reports. The behavior is still poorly understood, but brain scans of hoarders found that just the thought of disposing of junk mail or old newspapers causes abnormal activity in regions linked to decision-making. There is safety, comfort, and value in their possession, says Randy Frost, a Smith College psychologist. As extreme clutter takes over, it buries ovens, showers, and beds. Utility bills get lost, and the water and lights are turned off, leading to unsanitary conditions and an alarming number of fires, started by candles lit in the place of electricity, which can then engulf neighboring homes. When hoarders strongly resist any help with their problem, a therapist told me I should at least throw out my papers, but I couldn't. A hoarder told local officials in California there were checks in there somewhere. And from the health and science section, the health scare of the week, heartburn and cancer. Frequent heartburn increases the risk of throat and vocal cord cancer by nearly 80%, a new study shows. In a study of 1,865 people, Brown University researchers found that those who reported having frequent heartburn proved far more likely to have developed throat or vocal cord cancer than those who didn't. That was true even when they had no high-risk habits, such as smoking or heavy drinking, and were not infected with the human papillomavirus, which can cause cancers of the head and neck. That strongly suggests gastric reflux, which causes frequent heartburn, is an independent risk factor for those cancers, study author Scott McGavin tells CBSNews.com. Gastric reflux, which occurs when stomach acid pushes up into the esophagus, can be caused by pregnancy, eating fatty, fried, or spicy foods, and drinking alcohol, juice, or soda. Researchers think that the acid damages the cells of the esophagus over time, making them more susceptible to cancer. Taking over the counter antacids appear to reduce cancer risk by 40%, while prescription antacids did not. That might be because people who take the more serious drugs have the most severe heartburn. And now from the health and science section, we'll move to the talking points section. In the Week magazine for this week, this particular article is entitled, Working Moms in Many Homes, the Main Breadwinner. In 2 out of 5 American homes, it's mom who brings home the bacon, said Kate Dries in Jezebel.com. A Pew Research Center study reveals that working mothers are now the primary breadwinners in a record 37% of households with children, up from 11% in 1960. Now, most of these primary breadwinners are single mothers, but 40% of the women in the survey are married and out-earn their husbands, making a sea change in our society's gender roles and the economy itself. Still, Americans remain ambivalent about this ongoing transformation, said Philip Bump in the AtlanticWire.com. 3/4 tell Pew it's harder for families with working moms to bring up children, and 51% still feel it's better for the mother to stay home to look after the kids while dad earns the bucks. But with many families requiring 2 incomes to make ends meet, the country is quickly leaving the Leave It to Beaver model behind. Ladies, if you want to work, that's fine, said Eric Erickson in RedState.com. But let's not kid ourselves. The ideal and optimal family arrangement is the traditional nuclear family with mom at home. Look at what science has revealed about the animal kingdom. The male protects and provides for his family, while the female tames the male beast and nurtures the next generation. Ignoring what's natural is bad for children and is killing our society. That's a pretty narrow view of the natural world, said Will Wilkinson in Economist.com. There is, in fact, a stupefying variety in the animal kingdom. Male and female foxes team up to provide food for their offspring, for example, while female bonobos bond into groups and dominate the males. In hunter-gatherer human societies, women actually contribute more food to the clan, while men hunt mainly to display to one another and to the women how fierce and manly they really are. Perhaps this habit of posturing explains why threatened modern males like Eric Erickson feel such a need to pound their chests, bellow, and defend the prerogatives of men. It's also nonsensical to insist that working moms are bad for kids, said Elsif Reeve in the AtlanticWire.com. An analysis of dozens of studies has found that children of working moms do no worse academically or behaviorally than those of stay-at-home moms and are actually less likely to suffer from depression and anxiety. Meanwhile, the country's crime rates and teen pregnancy rates are at record lows. The divorce rate is declining, and the literacy rate is around 99%. America is kind of awesome, actually, despite all these terrible working women. It's not awesome for everyone, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com, especially not in families where the primary breadwinner is a single mother. Those moms are more likely to be black or Hispanic and very young, and they earn a miserable median income of $23,000 a year, less than half the mean income of a household with 2 working parents. Their kids are likely to grow up in poverty. In other words, there is a sharp, discernible class divide between working moms, and on the wrong side of it, there is mostly desperation and poverty. So let's not put a pretty egalitarian gloss on what it is actually a troubling trend, said Bradford Wilcox in NationalReview.com. Yes, it's a good thing that bright and capable women are being integrated into the American workforce. But the reason many women out-earn their husbands is that the men have been unemployed for years or are working low-paying part-time jobs. Add that to the boom of single motherhood and you have the familial ingredients of an American dystopia, not an androgynous utopia. True, we've hardly arrived at a happy new egalitarian paradise, said Hannah Rosen in Slate.com. But it's equally clear that the old days aren't coming back. More women than men now are earning college degrees, while blue-collar men have seen their income steadily decline as jobs that involve hard physical labor disappear. Those trends, like the rise in working mothers, are only going to continue. It's time to stop arguing about whether or not women should be working and start looking for ways to improve the lives of everyone. The displaced men, the overworked single mothers, the guilty high-earning mothers. Now a few short items as we reach the end of our program this week. The 10 biggest tax breaks will save American taxpayers more than $900 billion this year, with 51% of the benefits going to the richest 20% of households, according to a new report by the Congressional Budget Office. The wealthiest 1%, those with at least $327,000 in annual income, got 17% of these tax benefits. In 2012, 11,098 people were killed by terrorism globally, according to a new report by the U.S. State Department. 10 were Americans. New York City hospitals are bracing for a 10 to 30% increase in births in late July, early August, 9 months after Hurricane Sandy left much of the city without electricity for several days. This is just old basic psychology, or rather physiology, I should say, said Dr. Jacques Moritz, who is director of gynecology at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center. There's no internet and no cable. What else is there to do? The global poverty rate, measured by how many people live on less than $1.25 a day, has halved from 43% in 1990 to 21% in 2010. Economic growth in China, India, and other developing nations has driven that reduction in poverty. The poll watch for this week, 68% of Americans say that the U.S. should not use military action in Syria if diplomatic efforts fail, while just 24% say they would support military involvement. Nonetheless, 58% believe diplomatic efforts and economic sanctions will fail to resolve the conflict in Syria. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.